There are some things that are too good to keep a secret. Like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Hello and welcome to the Prep to Pro NBA Draft Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Max Carlin. I'm joined as always by Jake. Jake, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great today, Max. How are you?
I am excited to record part two of this with our pal PD Webb. PD, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Excited to finish this out. On a different day as we record these every time, you know?
All right. So our next developmental topic to discuss is physical development. And the first guy is Scottie Barnes. Scottie Barnes can't really jump. Not that like he has a poor vertical. He doesn't seem to know how to jump. Like he doesn't really go up in the air. PD, what do you think is going on there biomechanically? And like, how correctable do you think it is? What are the implications of teaching him how to jump?
I just think he has really slow load times. He's just not a fast twitch athlete and is a player who has depended on like being strong, but not necessarily being quick in any, like, or not having any suddenness in any real direction, whether that with his handle, with his pop. Like, I think that on some level, it makes it easier to get him into a lineup because he will be a five long term, where the shooting and like general quickness is less of a concern. He'll have more time to let up for defensive actions. But I think that I'm farther away from him being a wing than I was during the season, and a real reversal from like preseason, where like 2 years ago I thought that Garuba was much, much closer to being a wing. And then after last year, I was like, oh no, it's Scotty who's closer to Garuba. And now I'm back to Garuba being much closer to being a wing than Scotty in the league.
Yeah, I just find his like interior play to be so weird, because his usage of length as a finisher is unique, that he just like reaches over people. He does, like, it's not like extension finishes or that sort of thing. It's like truly reaching over people, which I think stems from the fact that he can't jump. And then the reaching over people has like weird implications in that. I mean, I don't know that it is, but I think it certainly could be related to his poor touch. So I don't know. I tend to think that there could be some kind of domino effect from him improving as a leaper. But I don't know. It's just, he is a really weird leaper and just player on the interior in general. And like you said, like given that he kind of is a big man, that is pretty important.
Yeah, to add about the finishing, it's exactly what you put it, Max. He is simply just using his length to reach over guys. You don't really see that creativity or body contortion and kind of going around guys. It's kind of just, I'm going to go over top of you and see what happens. So it is really interesting. That's why I think he's probably farther away from being a wing. Like, I think in contrast, like PD was saying, in contrast to someone who I've just watched over the past weekend, Matthew Cleveland, who's going to Florida State next year. And of course, comparing him to Scotty is like, they're on opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of athleticism. But someone like Matthew Cleveland is a very good leaper, which in turn, and has good length, which in turn allows him to be much more effective at the rim. Scotty's otherworldly wingspan kind of gets canceled out a little bit as a finisher, because he can't, like you said, Max, get up or be creative or get around the defense and things of that nature.
Yeah, I would say that there's generally three pathways to finishing, or three different styles of finishing. You know, one is primarily flexibility. One is to, finish over. sorry, am I still quiet?
A little.
Okay, I can just retake that and then have him cut that out if you want.
Yeah, if you could.
How about now?
Yeah, you sound better now.
Okay. It's weird. I'm like way more on top of it than I was before.
Yeah, you're much louder now.
Okay. So I think that there's of the pathways, the finishing that are available to Scotty, he doesn't have flexibility, so that eliminates the sort of around methodology, and through isn't necessarily something that's available to him in close quarters because it's entirely extension based. He can't explode through contact. So he's going to either have to be a very technical finisher or be a very situational finisher. And I think that it's easier to see a world where he short rolls when it hits like little baby floaters of the 4 to 8 foot variety than it is to see him as somebody who can contort themselves and get it finishes with some English on it. To me, that's too many developments in too short of a time. And while like Scotty Barnes is one of my favorite players to watch and to just enjoy the Scotty Barnes experience in terms of rotations and his ability to problem solve, it's going to be difficult to build 4-man lineups around him that put as much playmaking and in his general deficiencies to like pack into an offensive alignment, because he is both a dramatic statistical negative, but also a dramatic tactical negative where teams are really going to have to think about how they want to deploy him.
Absolutely. Yeah. Jake, did you want to talk a little bit about strength gain for a couple of guys and how that could be a high leverage development?
Yeah. So I added Moses Moody to the list in strength gain, and the driving force of this is something we've talked about on air and off air. Is his footwork is beyond impressive, both off the catch, off the bounce. He has a little bit of a signature move that he's gone to a couple times in pre-college film that I watched in Arkansas, where it's the spin pullback directly into a step back. And again, like it's not very easy for him to create a ton of separation because he is rather limited as an athlete. However, this super technical footwork allows him to make up for it in some instances and allows him to get to spots and get in rhythm. So what I'm kind of wondering is if Moody is allowed or enabled to gain some strength, which would allow him to take hits, take bumps, and not necessarily just get bumped off of a spot the second he feels something at the point of attack. I'm wondering if that could, and I think it's my hunch that it could lead to, you know, a surge in shot making because he's able to get to more spots and leverage that footwork into some space creation. And his mechanics are very versatile and very fluid with that sort of one motion jumper he has going. And yeah, but I do think it does start with the strength gain. I think he's very similar to Zaire Williams. And I think Zaire kind of gets the majority of the attention in terms of unfinished athletes and how it hinders their current game. But I think Moody is also kind of in the same boat.
So I think that him and Zaire are two different sides of the same coin in terms of strength gains. I think that of Zaire as somebody who lacks strength but has balance. And I think of Moody as somebody who has the strength but has none of the balance. He in a lot, like his footwork can be at times balletic. And then he will also like fall down while landing on a jumper. I say this as leader of the Moody Mafia. That's always been why I bet on him. Was like, he's a really good shooter. He just doesn't know how to land yet. And I realized that he has a really difficult time with contact, not because he's not particularly strong, because like when you see him on defense, he can put up a fight. It's the finding a better center of gravity, being able to hold position, these gyroscopic activities are things that are extremely difficult for him. He's gotten dramatically better in the three and a half years that I've been watching him now, but it's still going to be a battle long-term. Whereas Zaire to me is just a classic case of like skinny guy that needs flexibility and general strength gains. With Moody, there's a little bit of a more difficult process because balance is more of an internal process rather than like a drill you can just do over and over again, where like Zaire's like, you need to work on stretching your hamstrings, guy.
The wait is finally over. Football is in full effect and the NBA is back. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at BetOnline. BetOnline is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to BetOnline today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
From rare dead stock to the latest release, you can find the exact sneaker you've been looking for on eBay. As the original sneaker marketplace, eBay is the place to go cop the pair you've been eyeing. With eBay's authenticity guarantee, a team of independent professional authenticators perform a rigorous inspection of the sneakers you purchase before they're sent to you, so you can confidently shop knowing your pair is the real deal. For sneaker sellers out there, eBay has estimated selling fees on sneakers over $100, making it free to sell or flip your collection. With other sites taking as much as 25%, you're going to have a lot of extra money left for more sneakers. Check out ebay.com/sneakers today.
Who put Nashawn Highland on the?
I did. Outline? I feel like it's really straightforward.
You want to get into it quickly?
Bones just needs some weight. He got to the rim more. The shot making is absolutely completely ludicrous. It's, you know, the volume and the shot quality stand out in that, like, they're difficult shots. He's taking a lot of them and they're going in. Just the ability for him to put on as much weight as possible. He's never going to be particularly bulky, but just can he withstand perimeter defense from bigger threes who can stick with him, having those counters, getting, upping the free throw rate. These are things to me that seem really straightforward. Where say there is a flexibility component with Bones, it's just figuring out how much he can put onto his frame and without losing any of the elasticity that he has.
Yeah. On the topic of flexibility, Jalen Johnson, can we find a way to get some pliability in his hips at all? Like, if you're looking for a way to make him more explosive downhill, more viable, moving laterally and turning, like, is that something that's doable? Can you, PD, think of any examples of guys who got like markedly more flexible in the NBA?
It's about where the flexibility arises. So, there's been a very good tracker with skinny guys and posterior chains. Like, I think one of the most dramatic ones is Brandon Ingram, who is a extremely inflexible player in high school and then during his short time at Duke. Now has, like, I wouldn't say incredible wiggle, but, like, his ability to slink is so much more gained because there's just less tightness through those hamstrings. Hips are funny. It can be a little bit more difficult because sometimes there's imbalances that are why there's inflexibility. At a certain point, it's just difficult to ask a 6'9" built guy to be also super flexible. Like, at a certain point, you're betting on a sliver of the human population to also do something that's very non-representative. I think that he's going to get better in time, but I think hip flexibility for somebody that size with that particular build is kind of difficult thing to ask for.
Yeah, no, that makes sense for sure. All right, the next category that we have is sort of like a conceptual understanding that we talked about with Henry back a couple weeks ago, approach, feel, that sort of thing. And the first guy that we have is Trey Mann. Jake, you want to talk through the Trey Mann thing a bit?
Yeah, so I brought up Trey Mann to you over text a couple of days ago. And something with Trey Mann is what we talked about in one of our first episodes, which was this idea of reactive passing versus proactive passing and whether you're driving, drawing help, and making the adequate decision because of what's given to you, or are you genuinely moving the defense, whether it be with your eyes or ball fakes and all, the different types of ways we discussed. With Trey Mann, he's somewhat in the middle right now. I'm not comfortable saying he's a legit proactive passer, and he still misses a few too many windows for my liking as someone who has the ball as much as he does. However, he is very reactive and very functional as a passer, especially off the lab dribble with both hands. And in the games I've watched later in the season, as he's progressed, I've seen him, he's not necessarily opening windows, but I'll say that he's holding them. And he does that usually with no looks. And it's, my question would be, now that he's taken that mini step from strictly reactive to somewhat not toying with the defense, but somewhat moving them with his eyes, is it feasible that we could see him take that next step into becoming a fully manipulative, proactive passer?
I do think with him, and maybe PD will get into this a bit more after, but I do think that there's like an approach aspect to it as well, that like Trey Mann is very much a scoring guard and he's trying to score at all times. Like he's trying to break guys down either to get to the rim or to floaters or usually to pull up jumpers. And like if by accident, or not by accident, but it, you know, if as a consequence of that attempt to score, the defense concedes passing windows, Trey Mann, like you said, can hold them and execute on them with really good functionality with his ability to pass off a live dribble and with his super smooth transition from dribble to pass. But it doesn't feel like he's getting to specific spots with the purpose of opening something. Like Sharif Cooper, David Johnson, these guys get to specific spots because they know the cause and effect is that's going to open this passing window. It doesn't feel like that's the approach with Mann. I don't know that it ever will be, but
what I'm going to say is I fully agree with you. I fully agree with you. That isn't the approach by any means right now. The question I would guess I'm sort of trying to pose is, given that we can all agree it isn't his approach right now, yet he's still able to make these somewhat nuanced reads, my question would be, is that something we should just take for what it is and move on? Or is it something worth extrapolating into future development, is basically what I'm getting at.
That's a tough one. I mean, that's the $100 million question at this point, because like if you believe that like Trey Mann is actually this version of Trey Mann is actually the worst one because he has the least understanding of how to win simple, then like there's an argument to have Trey Mann extraordinarily high in this draft. My issue is like in part one, we talked about like scheming guys to weakness, like that, you know, you don't want to have two super left-handed guys if you're running a two guard offense at the two guard spots, because it's difficult to find passes that will help both at the same time. And like with Trey Mann, I just get the feeling that like he struggles to make simple reads and win simply. And a lot of time he makes the wrong decision and it turns out well. So like he has an opening to his left and he drives right. Then he, you know, has a two-piece combo. And then comes back to his left and it's open because the handle is so nice. And I struggle to understand where that comes from, because to me it seems like a pretty obvious read. And maybe in a scheme where like, maybe in the league where you can't get away with that, he'll focus that down. I think that it is schematically feasible and organizationally feasible to make those first reads happen faster. I just don't think that there's going to be 100% translation of the separation. So that's why I might be a little bit lower than Trey Mann than others, just because like I think that the former will happen, that he will be able to make those reads quicker and get into a place where he is challenging all five pieces of the cohesive defense, not just man one-on-one. But I also think that the passing flashes that he has will be lesser, and the creation flashes will be lesser within that five-man context.
PD, what does it look like organizationally and schematically forcing him to be more simple?
I think that it would be in a two guard setup, or, you know, giving him, you know, a screen that's tilted one way and saying, this is what is going to happen if they're in ice. These are the reads that are going to happen basically every single time. Here's your window on the first dribble. Here's your window on the second dribble. Here's your window on the third dribble. And just drilling these basic reads home. I mean, like, look, every time that you're in this coverage, these three things will be there. Because a lot of times, like I think a lot of his best moments come like extemporaneously, where he's added a dribble into a set, or like a rotation is sort of frozen and he struggles at holding all five people on a string at the same point. I think that that's possible. It's just harder. The more of a focus, we've talked about this with Anthony Edwards, the more of a focus a guy is on an offense, the harder it is to drill in little things. Or it's so much easier when a guy is, you know, in a Jaden McDaniels type role where it's like, these are the things you're doing. If you do them well, you get more than it is to say like, okay, you're playing 40 minutes. We would like you to focus on these five things. Like that's a lot to ask for a teenager or a 20-year-old or a 21-year-old to be able to do.
So then, I mean, it could be a situation that, you know, it doesn't seem like it's going to cost a top five pick to invest in Trey Mann. Could that, you see that as beneficial then, that, you know, he could be looking at going later to a team that could deploy him in limited minutes alongside another accomplished creator?
Okay, I don't necessarily think that, like, limited minutes is sort of part of the thing. Like, you can play somebody in a lot of minutes, but in a more concise role. I think the difficulty is when, you know, they are the offense unto themselves and they have to just, like, I guess you could point to, like, what Kevin Porter Jr. was doing in the G League. As, like, Kevin Porter Jr. wasn't there to, like, work on a role. It was like, okay, expand your game. A lot of times it can feel that way for young guys. So if they're, like, a top three pick and they're the offense, suddenly it's hard to work on little things. I think that any team that can get him into a secondary or tertiary role, regardless of the minutes, that he can work on certain reads, that he can work on keeping a defense in check, and that advantage will be created for him. So it's like, well, you lost this advantage. When you're going through the film, it's like, yeah, you scored, but good things happened, but an advantage was created for you and you lost, whether it's through a pick and pop or, you know, a DHO or whatever. So I think that for him especially, like, falling could be really vital. And, like, I've generally been a proponent of guys falling because second contract money is so much better than first contract money. And, like, who cares if you go top five, if some guy, you know, goes 15 and he gets the max in year seven or whatever. It is a marathon in that way. Like, he's the guy I think would most benefit in that, like, top conversation of falling, because there's a lot of circumstances that would make a lot of sense for him in a long-term development.
The wait is finally over. Football is in full effect and the NBA is back. You might not be at a game this year, but you can still be in on the action at Bet Online. Bet Online is going the extra mile to make sure you can get in on everything imaginable this season. From game spreads and totals to team, player, and coaching props, BetOnline gives you more options to wager than any place online. Head to BetOnline today and use promo code ARMCHAIR to take advantage of all the great sign-up bonuses. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
From rare dead stock to the latest release, you can find the exact sneaker you've been looking for on eBay. As the original sneaker marketplace, eBay is the place to go cop the pair you've been eyeing. With eBay's authenticity guarantee, a team of independent professional authenticators perform a rigorous inspection of the sneakers you purchase before they're sent to you, so you can confidently shop knowing your pair is the real deal. For sneaker sellers out there, eBay has estimated selling fees on sneakers over $100, making it free to sell or flip your collection. With other sites taking as much as 25%, you're going to have a lot of extra money left for more sneakers. Check out ebay.com/sneakers today.
Jake, anything to add on Trey Mann?
No. I mean, I got everything that I wanted to say, and I definitely think PD made some valid points that I certainly agree with.
Cool. Then we're good to move on to Jonathan Kuminga, who, you know, has a lot of physical abilities to work with and has moments of being overwhelming, I think, physically and from a skill standpoint, but definitely has approach issues. Doesn't really have much developed in the way of counters. So PD, how do you go about making Kuminga maybe like having a more malleable approach and sort of developing a better feel, not for necessarily reading the court, but for like reading situations and how to, you know, apply himself and his skills?
I think there is a danger in being a prospect like Jonathan Kuminga, because there's not naturalistic consequences to making mistakes. If Kuminga takes the wrong move, like if he's driving and somebody's leaning a little bit left and he goes between the legs behind the back, he can still close that gap because he's so physical, because he's so explosive, because he has a good understanding of driving angles, and that way he gets a hip at the right level a lot. And so, like, even in the G League, there were times where, like, he would make the wrong read and it would work out just because, like, he's so talented. So I think that part of guys like who come into his category, and like Jaylen Brown is sort of like this, I think it was exasperated by going to Cal, where like he was like teams could just load up against him specifically, and I think that numbed his numbers quite a bit. Where if he had gone to a different fit circumstance, I would never slander the University of California Berkeley like that, but if he had gone to a better fit where he was a little bit less offensive load, he could probably have looked a little bit better. I think with Kuminga, in a circumstance where there are like guys who can hang with him in the league, when he makes mistakes, there will be a naturalistic consequence. Cause like, you know, a guy like OG can get that shot. You know, there's going to be players who will beat him to spots and are as strong, if not stronger. So I think that part of this is just the exposure to players who have the mixture of physicality and the understanding of angles and a team defense behind them, where the simple solution often doesn't work and you have to make the smart, simple solution every single time.
Yeah, I think the Jaylen Brown like example is relevant because you're talking about a guy who's undergone like the most incredible skill development ever, but approach issues still crop up. And so if he is in an isolation at the top of the key, like I think it's the jab left, rip attack right that he kind of does all the time, or maybe it's the reverse of that. And sometimes it's like, you know, very much not what the situation calls for. Like that's not how you should be attacking that defender. And it can work. It can just work anyway, because he's an extraordinarily explosive player. But like sometimes it's also going to happen that you're not doing what the defense is like requiring of you to beat them, and you're going to get ripped or someone's going to beat you a spot and it's going to be an easy charge. And those are limiters. And it's evidently something that's really hard to address, like to get this approach to change, to get this understanding of when to apply these skills and physical abilities, even if you actually have them, which is a like huge bar to clear, but you then have to know how to apply them.
Yeah. And honestly, for me, my biggest critique with Kuminga, and this reared its head, especially in the G League bubble, and was a concern coming into the pre-draft year, is the sort of domino effect that these lack of counters have on his game and approach. It's initially, I'm going to try to get downhill, I'm going to give you a shoulder drop, and either you're going to go flying and I'm going to be able to finish through you, or I'm going to get stripped or called for a charge. And the possessions that follow with that are, if the drive and the shoulder drop aren't working, we've seen him settle for these pull-up mid-range jumpers or pull-up threes. And while he's somewhat capable as a shooter and it's not a horrendous shot, it's more of the thought process that it showcases, where it's basically like, look, my initial move at the rim wasn't working, so instead of going with a Euro step or going with a spin move or showing you a ball fake when I get to the rim, I'm just going to abort that completely and kind of put myself in this wing pull-up shooter, get mine off the bounce roll, which is kind of counterintuitive of the type of player he can be and the impact that he can bring as a super freak athlete in terms of strength on the wing. But, you know, the lack of counters certainly rears its head at the rim. And then what I kind of have this big fear of is the domino effect that follows.
Yeah, I worry... What follows for him when the rigid approach that he has doesn't work, because what he falls back on is usually not good. Like he's usually proceeds to then not make very good decisions and get himself into precarious spots, which tends not to end well. Should we move on to PD wants to group Alperen Sengun and Cam Thomas, the very, very natural grouping. PD, do you want to get into why you're grouping those two players?
Yeah, to me, they are the same problem presented in positionally opposite ends of the spectrum. Both of them are offense presenting prospects. Both of them are probably best murdering second units and are best having to like not be exposed to like huge defensive liability. That also allows for huge usage. Cam and Sengun are like statistical outliers in production for considering their age and their experience level. And to me, there's sort of two pathways you can take with players like this. Is you sort of like try to fit them into a starting lineup where you're getting none of the offensive explosion, really, because they're on a smaller usage, but you're also exposing them to defensive liability. Or you can make them second unit stars, give them dramatic usage. They only have to guard second unit guys, and you can really craft where and when and how you use them. You know, you can run them off whatever actions you want. There's a little bit more allowance for inefficiency problems. There's not the natural type of guy that gives them trouble. And I think that that second way of immediately using them as primaries on a second unit, or, you know, against sort of like the soft spot of a defense, makes a lot of sense to me, and I think has a ton of value for teams that are capable of deploying it that way. Obviously, it requires buy-in from the players. It requires buy-in for pretty much everybody. This is an extremely valuable thing. Like, Lou Williams has had a career, and Iskander has had a career. Like, we don't, there's a joke about his defense, but like, against the right matchup in the playoffs, like, that dude will just frolic on points. I think that for teams that do need second unit scoring and can, and has like the organizational continuity to pitch and cash in on this vision, this is a category of player that I think is an interesting value proposition.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because like the two extremes of the positional spectrum are kind of where I feel like the bucket getter who bleeds points defensively is like most vulnerable, because you're, you know, as a big like Sengun, you're very targetable. Like, you can literally just put him in a ball screen every single play. And then with Thomas, you can do the same thing, or then if there are attempts to hide him off the ball, you're then, you know, compromising your team defense by virtue of having a guy who's not particularly involved or reliable, as well as having the size advantage. So it's not like, you know, that's why if you're a 6'7" bucket getter, you know, you're a superstar prospect. Whereas with these guys, like, you can be this, and they are like historically productive players for their age and competition level. And it just, when you reach a certain level of defensive flammability, it just exposes you so badly in terms of your lineup construction.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have a ton to add. I haven't personally seen Sengun, and Cam Thomas is sort of an interesting case as a prospect to me. And if I'm going to get behind him, it's going to have to be in the role that PD sort of carved out, which is as this second unit microwave king. Because my biggest issue with Cam Thomas, honestly, is the ball stopping and how he gets his buckets. I think in terms of comparing to like other people on draft Twitter, I might be a quote unquote drafter, or whoever you want to quantify that group as. I think I might be a little bit more open to the guy who can get a ton of buckets off the bounce in a variety of ways, but it's only to an extent. And at some point with Cam, the A button has to start working again and the defense has to be somewhat salvageable, but it all starts with his role within the context of an offense. And that's the sort of hurdle that I can't get over with him.
See, the funny thing is though, is that everyone's in on that player if they're good enough at it. It's just these guys are like really interesting demonstrations of how good you have to be at these things. Like, you know, you're talking about guys that are like historically good, and it's not even necessarily the case that they're good enough. Yeah, Sengun's really interesting to me because it's like, what does the like small in height, really immobile big man have to be as a prospect, like built around their offense? What do they have to be like an elite prospect?
The spirit of performance is what defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and a broom. A performance-enhancing broom. My name is John Cullen. I'm a comedian, podcaster, and for 20 years, I was a semi-professional curler. And I want to tell you the story about how a single broom almost imploded the 500-year-old sport of curling.
We felt like we were bringing a knife to a gunfight.
It's the story of a superstar and his fall from grace.
Well, I was being dragged through the mud.
It's the story of two brother entrepreneurs with a dream.
I said, that's great news.
It's a story of intrigue.
I still don't understand why we want to keep his name secret.
The full story has never been told, so I'm going to tell it. Broomgate, how a broom almost killed curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
To listen to Broomgate, search for Broomgate in your favorite podcast app. That's all one word, Broomgate.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
See, that's a question that I think we'll eventually get to as like some of these contradictions get heightened. But I think that part of the like competent wing, like rush just to get as many wings as possible, is that there are lineups where like bad, like physically unimposing wings are on the floor and they are the tag man. And you, if you have the right big man to just spam pick and roll, where you just keep feeding them for like 6 foot dump offs, like there are buckets to be had. And like my issue with Cam is that like I think that there are times where you can get like extraordinary value out of Cam, especially if it were like a team that needed second unit punch. Like it was like a playoff team wanted like extreme rookie value. I would suggest like trading up for Cam or you know figuring out what you have to do to get him. The problem is that like on a team that maybe would pick him that high that was bad, like he's not particularly useful. Like he is one of those players that like is sort of the pitch for like for Mikal Bridges, where it's like on a good team he's extraordinarily valuable and on a bad team he's nothing, but it's just a little bit less comfortable because it requires a buy-in from the player to be like, look, unfortunately, like you're probably not going to be an NBA star, but Lou Williams made $75 million in his on-court career, not counting off-court stuff, and he did not have this cap. You could make roughly that much money in your career. All you have to do is keep scoring and you have to come off the bench. Like to me, as a person who I think aligns with players a lot, like or who empathizes with players a lot more, it can be difficult to be like, yeah, this guy's a bench guy. But like there are teams that need scoring punches on the second unit, and that will win play if you can get him in the right environment, that will win playoff games. I'm a little less sold on Sengun because like the translation bugs me. And yeah. He's in a league that doesn't have like the type of guy who's going to give him problems, which is like my test for how good a league is like, is the guy who bugs you in there. And so I'm a little less sold, but like Cam Thomas is a guy where it's like if you were to like Philly can't use Cam Thomas, that's not a place that would just be like, that's not worth two playoff wins.
Yeah. There are always teams that can use off the dribble creation. There are always good teams that can use off the dribble creation.
And the good teams have the Mitchell quote that I talk about a lot. It's like when you get to the league and James Harden's going to say, get off the ball. Joel Embiid's going to say, give me the ball. Like in an environment where you have bona fide stars, it's a lot easier to tell a rookie that like, hey, you only have to make one adjustment, not two. Like your usage won't go down, but you're going to come off the bench. Where if you pick them high, suddenly like you're going to have to make some changes to them, and suddenly you're losing the thing that makes them special in exchange for sort of working around them. And at that point, we're not operating with the same value proposition.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a tough like psychological situation to navigate. Are you guys ready to move on to spotlight skill?
Go with me.
Okay. Jake, did you have Davion? Is that you?
Yeah, I have Davion.
Yeah, you want to knock that out first?
Yep. So this isn't exactly new news, but it's something that I haven't watched a ton of like film in the past couple of days on my computer, just been kind of overwhelmed with some college stuff, but I was able to watch the actual Sweet 16, Elite Eight, and Final Four games. And Davion Stansel-Burst was just an incredible asset in those games. And as someone who had previously struggled to make nuanced playmaking reads, him blowing by his point of attack defender so smoothly and easily and causing just incredible rotations. I've seen him make some skip passes that I really was not expecting to see. And it's all a byproduct of that standstill burst. So I just wanted to give a quick shout out to him there. Still kind of weeding out where he fits on the positional spectrum. But if there's one thing I know for certain, it's that he's an absolute nutty athlete.
Yeah, Davion from a burst and change of direction, stop, start, he's explosive. He's really, really explosive. My guy is Santi Aldama. Played for Loyola Maryland in the Patriot League. Not a high level of competition, but Aldama's patience as a help defender and his discipline as a help defender are really, really exceptional. The one thing that I kind of question is, you know, to what extent is he enabled in his, you know, having length and having an ability to cover ground at that level that is adequate. But I definitely wonder if that's still going to be the case once everything is happening much, much, much faster. And we could do an entire episode on the context in which Aldama is playing, because it's very interesting for a whole host of reasons. But the patience as a help defender is like currently a really, really strong attribute, I would say, and it contributes a lot to his defensive impact at Loyola. But I think it just presents interesting questions in terms of translation. PD, did you wanted to finish this off with some Josh Giddey talk?
Yeah. So I guess this will be my spotlight skill and also my plug at the same time. I've been watching a bunch of Josh Giddey for a project I have coming up, and to me, he is the most interesting prospect in this class. Both from like a how does this translate perspective, and also like watching his NBL games as an experience. He is a technically proficient defender who seems to never make, like doesn't seem to make impact plays commensurate with his positioning. He is a player who understands the mechanics of offense and the expectations of where he needs to place his drives, place his passes. And like when he is needed to shoot at a level that is extremely advanced, he knows where his advantage needs to come from. He knows where the defenders are going to rotate. And he also just like has a willingness to attempt just insane passes. There are some skips. There are some duck-ins. There's a lot of stuff that is pretty eye-popping, in addition to him being a developmental shooter that I would say makes him the most interesting player in this class. I am hosting a Twitch event on the 14th at 9 p.m. Eastern, where live with the help of a guest, we'll be breaking down a full game of Josh Giddey to talk about what I see on film, what I look for, breaking down the sets that are run, breaking down the historical development, breaking down micro skills, breaking down sort of comparative elements that I think has never really been done where it's like, this is the process of doing this. And would appreciate if, or I think that anyone who is a fan of this podcast would get something out of it.
Oh yeah. We're going to be aggressively sharing that because I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Sounds like it should be an exciting guest as well. So I'm definitely looking forward to it. And it seems like it should be a new, a genuinely new form of content, in this space, which is pretty cool. All right. I think, that'll probably do it for part two. PD, thank you so much for coming on, taking the time. Everyone, please check out that, the live stream. I can't remember what day you said that it is, but I'm sure you'll be plugging it at Above the Break 3 on Twitter. We'll be sharing it and plugging it. Jake at Jake in the Paint, me at Max A. Carlin. Maybe we'll even toss a retweet from the pod account, the very active Prep to Pro Pod at Twitter. Maybe we'll be, getting on there and mobilizing our massive audience to watch your live broadcast. Anything else, anyone?
I actually have something to half plug. I can't fully give it away right now. I'm not sure if it'll be public by the time this pod gets post, but I have an exciting announcement to share. It'll be on my Twitter. It's hard to explain it without getting into what it actually is, but what I'll say is just stay tuned. Have an exciting opportunity coming up that, we'll leave it at that. Just stay tuned to my Twitter and hopefully you guys enjoy that when it comes about.
All right. I think with that, we're done.
Thank you guys for listening.